It's simple. It's dumb. It's the podcast. It's simple, it's dumb, it's the podcast, where we speak with friends and fans of Jason Lytle about Granddaddy, his songwriting, and anything else that happens to come up. Today, our special guest is a member of the band that Jason has formed a close bond with over the last 10 years. Today's guest is Eric Polito from the amazing band Midlake.
Whenever I was a child, I wonder what if my name had changed into something more productive like Roscoe. Been born in 1891, waiting with my aunt Roseline. Thought we were due for a change or two around this place. When they get back, they're all mixed up with no one to stay.
Midlake is a folk rock band with roots going back to the turn of the century in Denton, Texas. Eric initially joined Midlake as a guitarist and stepped into the lead vocalist role as well shortly after Tim Smith left the group. Midlake has received a ton of critical acclaim over the years, and one of the people who was paying close attention was Jason Lytle himself. In this episode, we'll hear all about how the relationship between Jason and Midlake came to pass, and we'll also talk about the supergroup project Banquet that incorporated Midlake, Jason, and others back in 2017. Eric, of course, also gives us his background as a fan of Granddaddy and how he first met Jason. Okay, enough of me. Let's hear from Eric himself. Here's my conversation with Eric Polito. Tell me about the first time that you heard Granddaddy music.
So the first time, I was a little late. It was 2000 when the Software Slump came out. And a friend of mine had put a Broken Household Appliance National Forest on like a, just like a mix CD, with a bunch of other music. And, I just remember really falling in love with that tune specifically. And just like any song that you hear on a mixtape, the radio, whatever, it can kind of send you down a rabbit hole. And I was always like that anyways. I still am, you know, where you hear something like, oh, I want to know more. I want to hear more. And it was kind of my gateway drug into Granddaddy. And I just fell in love with the band and went back and got Under the Western Freeway, fell in love with that record and just was hooked ever since. It was kind of a big time. I mean, it was, what's kind of funny, you know, I mean, I'm sure Coldplay was probably on that same CD, you know, that I had gotten, but it was such a weird time where, you know, whatever was indie, you know, was kind of, I don't know if that word really was a thing, but it became really important to be kind of quote unquote independent for our band because, you know, even Granddaddy, like being on V2, like it made V2 like really cool to us. And we got signed to a label called Bella Union who put out, they're basically like European partner was V2. We're like, it's so cool. We're on the same label essentially, with Granddaddy, you know? And so, it was like that. I can't, emphasize enough how huge that band, was and is to us for our early years of just, you know, trying to figure out how to do something that might be a little left of center but still make some semblance of a career. I mean, that probably seems such a stretch, but you know, for us, they were really pioneers in making music like that and being able to tour the world.
Yeah, it seems like most of the members of Midlake, if not all of them, have this admiration for Granddaddy and Jason's songwriting. In fact, in preparing for this episode, I discovered this anecdote from the Dallas Observer like years ago, where the writer had been to a concert with Midlake drummer Mackenzie Smith, and Mackenzie turned to him in the middle of the show and said, "This is probably my favorite band of all time." And maybe that's hyperbole a little bit, but that's pretty high praise, right? That the whole band has the same sort of appreciation for this.
Yeah, no, we were. I mean, you know, especially in those early days, you know, it was such a pivotal time for us, especially, you know, the band's roots, you know, were in a very, you know, trained musical background of jazz with, you know, going through UNT music school. So a lot of these bands that were kind of would be considered obviously like more indie, you know, and just have like a rawness about it was kind of a new school for the band. And so we were kind of delving into this music and like we did really with every record, we always kind of took a left turn as kind of like our teaching. And it was a very honest and authentic thing, but we would delve into these artists and these records and just, you know, fall in love with it and talk about it and really it would help form and shape what we were doing. And you can hear that on our first record, Famine and Sliver Cork, with bands like Granddaddy and I mean, it, you know, Flaming Lips, you know, Neutral Milk, Bell and Sebastian, obviously big ones like Radiohead and Bjork and stuff. But we were just, there were a lot of those bands that were pivotal and continued to be as we kind of like, you know, a band kind of evolves and you kind of take different influences. You still have those, I think, those roots in our formative years. And Granddaddy's definitely one of those bands that helped shape us.
Cool. So fast forward a few years, how did you come to find out that Jason was a fan of Midlake's music?
So, we went on tour, after releasing, The Courage of Others, or right around that time in 2010. And we were going for the first time, through Montana. And, I guess we had maybe released the dates, the tour dates, and maybe put them on sale. And I can't remember fully. I think John Grant was going to be support on the tour, if I'm not mistaken. And Jason saw that we were coming through Montana and contacted either our manager or booking agent. And then it came through to us and said, "Hey, Jason Lytle, contacted and asked if he could open the show." We're like, "What?" And we're like, "Yeah, I mean, of course he can open the show. Like, would he want to do more shows than just that one?" And it, you know, came back to us. He was like, "Yeah, he's down to do, I think that whole run that we were doing." I was like, "This is amazing." So we all got in a van together with our musical idol, Jason Lytle, opening the shows for us, and just had an amazing time together, and tried probably not to annoy him and bug him because we're such big fans, you know. And it just ended up being just one of those tours that you remember of just bonding and having fun. And we even, like, we never did covers. We never did covers. And we would do, we did "I Need You," mm-hmm. "America," with Jason.
Thank you.
eventually we did more tours with them, and we started doing like AM 180 together, and it kind of became like a thing where it's like, you think Jason would want to go on tour with us, you know? We went on a few runs together, and it was just a blast. But that was when we met. It was really great.
That had to be completely surreal. I mean, I can only imagine like one of your icons wanting to play for you and tour with you, and you're sharing the stage with him at some points and on that tour and stuff. That just had to be crazy to process even.
It was, but you know, I mean, to know Jason is to love him. And I felt like, you know, I think a lot of times it can be scary, you know, to obviously meet someone that is like a musical hero or an idol, you know, and it can kind of get ruined, you know? But he's so just so kind and just awesome to be around. And for us, it was it became a mutual admiration and friendship from that. And really cherish that. And every time I see him, I just try not to annoy him too much, you know, just like, I love this guy. He's so great. I just, hope he'll, want to hang out again.
Jason's a bit older than I think all of you guys in the band. Is his role more so as just a friend, or is he also kind of act as a big brother mentor type when it comes to things like recording or touring or just anything in the music industry? Just curious if that ever developed there.
I mean, I definitely, you know, just by proxy, yeah, being like I guess you could say an elder, you know, but not so much as age of just like he did it before us, you know.
Right.
And it's kind of cool because as time's gone by and you realize some of your mutual admirations of like musical or otherwise of like a band like ELO and Jeff Lynne, and you're like, that makes sense, you know. Mm-hmm. There's so much like you kind of uncover just by shooting the shit and hanging out and being on a bus together and, you know, talking about, life or influences and such. So yeah, a lot of that, through time did, you know, get uncovered. As far as recording, I mean, yeah, definitely in conversation because you're just curious of like, how did you do that? What did y'all use? You know? And then obviously full circle with Banquet of recording, with him, which, even more than meeting someone, like now playing with them and then like recording with them, you're like, it really was a cool project, but also especially for those that weren't remote and we were doing it in the studio, which Jason was with us in the studio, you kind of get a little look behind the curtain or a peek behind the curtain of how this mad scientist, you know, might work. And also inherently doing a collaboration like that, it kind of forces you to let go a little bit too, which can kind of, I think for all of us, be a little bit cathartic, because I'm sure he, like Midlake, you know, we would slave over recordings and everything just mattered so, so much, sometimes to a fault where you get the law of diminishing returns, you know, and you try to find that balance. But Banquet was just, it kind of had an easiness and just a fun natured, aspect to it. But that was really, really cool to be in a studio and playing and making kind of decisions quickly, because, you know, we only had a couple days with each artist. That was a cool way to really kind of dig into the mind of Jason Lytle.
Yeah. So let's talk about Banquet a little bit more here, because it included Ben Bridwell, who we've already spoken to in episode one. It included Fran Healy, who I think is also one of Jason's close friends, Alex Kapranos, and all these guys. You're right. They I think they came in and maybe recorded in Denton at Redwood Studios, or they would have probably submitted things from a remote location. So Jason contributed two songs to this. It was 100 Million Miles and Failing at Feeling.
Right.
I'm not afraid.
what shape were those songs when they were brought to the group in Denton? Are those just rough demos at that point?
Yeah, I feel like he did send us something before he came so we could like hear it just in a raw format. I'm pretty sure because I feel like that was the case with most everybody where we just heard something, you know. But you know, it's kind of regardless, you know, and you turn up, it's kind of like the nature of it is like, you know, you show me yours, I'll show you mine kind of thing. Just like get a guitar, or get on the piano, you know, everybody kind of listen and kind of, you know, them kind of sharing what they're thinking, you know, what they're feeling like, could work, you know, and then you just start playing. So they were just in a, you know, a demo type state. It is possible with his, you know, that he had some more instrumentation, but I can't remember 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. So what about the dynamic? You mentioned earlier that, excuse me, that, you guys all went to music school in Denton. Jason's obviously self-taught and developed his craft over the years through probably just a lot of, hard work and trial and error. How does that dichotomy kind of, work when you're working together on something like that?
Well, I, you know, for me especially, I could appreciate it because I was self-taught also. I went to a different university, and when I moved up to Denton, I did take some music classes just to understand, you know, a little bit more, and just my own, you know, love of music and desire to know maybe what the guys were talking about a little bit better. So I kind of was backwards in that way. But I'm sure everybody could probably, you know, say at some point, you know, there was just a more natural progression of music, and then you go through training. But I know firsthand that training kind of was a double-edged sword, you know, for everybody. And there was always kind of this talk of kind of unlearning, you know, just because, you know, and you hear it all the time, you know, when things just sound so methodical or something, it's not like a raw, natural expression. And I think that's something we always long for, and something that I think Jason does so well, where it's, I mean, obviously he writes beautiful songs with beautiful melodies. He has a natural recognition and relationship with harmony. But yet in these songs, it feels so, it just feels very, like the wheels could come off at any time as well, you know?
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. I always felt like his approach has to be considered unorthodox by many probably great musicians who would look at it and say, this isn't how it's supposed to be done, but yet it.
And that's, I love that in music where you don't want to think about like, oh, that sounds really weird and complicated. It just sounds like a song, you know, and yeah. they make it just sound so natural. And then maybe you learn it and you're like, oh, that is kind of not what I would do. But that's also the great thing about writing and evolving and being a fan of other music, because it helps shape you.
Yeah. So a little bit more on Banquet. How did you get Jason to go along with this idea? Was it an easy sell for you?
So, you know, we were at the end of our cycle of our last Midlake record, and I was just kind of overdoing the cycle of, you know, record, tour, write, record, tour, whatever. And I didn't have, you know, kids at the time. I hadn't done any like other much of like other bands or musical expressions of my own. And so it was just kind of, I think a time that we all said, hey, let's put the ship back in the dock. Maybe we'll take it back out. Maybe not, but I want to do some other things. And at the time, you know, my favorite band of all time is The Band. And I just kind of loved how they rotated, like who was singing, you know. There was no pure lead singer. They just kind of would rotate. And I was like, man, I kind of want to do that and just see if there's other folks out there that would be interested. And we were friends with Jason by then and Ben as well, and had done some touring with Band of Horses, and Fran we had known for a little while as well and been mutual fans, and a friend of his and had seen him on that cycle. He was living in Berlin. I had never met Alex before, but a friend kind of hooked us up, and that's kind of how he got involved. But I sent this out to everybody of kind of my, I don't know, manifesto, my, like, you know, my pitch, I guess, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was resounding yeses by everybody, and I was so blown away and excited. There were no real strings attached and no real plan. It was just like, hey, you want to come to Denton, break some bread, have some drinks, and you know, record some music together. Didn't really know much past that, or if we would ever play it out, which luckily we did get to play a little bit. And with Jason, we had also done I don't know if you'd ever heard about or seen that we did a thing called Grand Lake, where we did some shows that were just like, basically were just his backing band playing Granddaddy songs and like a couple Mid Lake songs as well. So
yeah, I've seen those. Those looked like they were fun times for sure.
Yeah, they were.
I remember there was one spot in one of the clips I saw where y'all were like giving shit to him for getting your song's lyrics or something like that. And I was laughing like crazy at that. So what's in the store for the future in terms of Banquet? Is there a volume 2 at some point out there?
You know, the grand idea kind of, which we'll see how it kind of plays out, but was to do multiple volumes with a different cast every time. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. We recorded the second volume with some other contributors, and you know, obviously this past year and a half has kind of thwarted some things, and then now we're doing Mid Lake again. So it's always kind of out there in the ether of doing more music and really just recording. Kind of, I mean, maybe it's kind of how you do. You just kind of record as it happens, and then it kind of just lays out in some way. So continuing to record more contributors and then possibly placing them in a volume 2 and a volume 3, so on and so forth. But when we play out, throwing a wide net to everybody that's contributed and saying, hey, do you want to go on this tour? Here's the information. Here's, you know, what we're going to do. And then when we go on tour, it's Banquet featuring whoever said yes and could go do it. So
that's whoever is available.
Yeah. And then another thing I thought about doing, which would be fun, is kind of doing a yearly festival like Banquet Fest, you know, and it has these folks, whoever says yes. And we play just like we did on tour. We play the Banquet songs, but we also play some of their hits, as it were, you know?
Yeah. So one other thing that I saw out there in the internet is, I guess it was a Tom Petty festival in Denton, where Jason must have been in town, maybe to record Banquet, and ended up taking the stage with you to play one or two songs, I think.
Yeah,
if I recall.
There was a festival called Oaktopia that happened in Denton, and we kicked off the first night with it's a group called Best Fest that does honors different iconic artists like Tom Petty, by having, you know, different artists just come up and sing a song. And so we, because the festival is going on, we had several artists that were coming to do their own set. And then we said, hey, would you want to come in a day early and, you know, do a song for the Petty Fest? Mm-hmm. And Jason was one that wasn't actually coming to play. And I just said, hey, we'll fly you down and pay you to come in and do a Petty song or two. And he's like, okay. You know, so I'm probably running out of like favors to ask of Jason, you know, or I need to space them out, you know, like, would you come do this? Or you want
He had already done that. I Need to Know song back as a cover a long time ago. So he just pulled that out. I'm sure he already had that one in his back pocket.
Well,
so
he did well. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else, Eric?
I actually first met Jason as a fan. I know we talked about kind of meeting him more and doing the tour, but
yeah,
we actually met him years before. And I'll tell this this quick story. And
yeah,
but, and I've told it on stage actually with Jason, which he corrected me, which I'm not 100% if it's true or not, but we were at South by Southwest. It was 2003 and Granddaddy was playing in Austin, La Zona Rosa. And of course we went to the show. I still have like pictures that I took of the, not just the show, but his pedal board. Their pedal board. I probably took a picture of Jim and Jason's pedal board. Like, oh man, what are they using to get these sounds? You know?
Yeah.
And after the show, we went to a bar and lo and behold, Jason and Jim are there. And I have a copy of like the demo or just, and it wasn't a demo. It was like a just unreleased copy. I think my personal copy of our record that was forthcoming. Mm-hmm. And I was with McKenzie and I was, you know, really nervous. And I went up to him and I'm sure they didn't want to be bugged. I'm like, hey, Eric, we're in a band called Midlake. And this is our forthcoming record. And I remember McKenzie saying, yeah, he doesn't even have another copy. Like, that's his only copy. You know, like, we just love your band and, you know, kind of being my sidekick, you know, and trying not to, you know, like bug him or anything and just be like, yeah, I just want to give it to you if you like it, you know, or I hope you like it. You know, I've been such a big influence and just kind of gushing.
Yeah.
And that was it. And I kind of fast forward to the banquet tour and I kind of shared this and I said, I'm sure it became like, you know, Road Rash Records where it went out the window or in the trash. And he's like, actually, I did listen to it and I loved it. And I fell in love with Midlake. And I'm like, okay, this could be a lie, but I'm going to believe it because that's quite awesome that, you know, even the fact that you would, you know, you would think that unsolicited music to a band that you love would be listened to, but obviously that was my hope. It was pretty cool. But that's actually the first time I met them. And actually, yeah. I think after that we were going back to the hotel and we go up to the hotel and it opens up and guess who's in the elevator? But all five members of Granddaddy. And we're kind of like, oh, hi. You know, it's like awkward, you know.
Yeah, we're not stalking you or anything.
Yeah, exactly. then there was a bit of a pause between that and when I went to, obviously, to Granddaddy shows throughout the years. I saw them in they opened up actually for Coldplay in New York, 2001, yeah. Radio City. I went to that. They did a tour with Pete Yorn. I went to that show in Dallas. And I remember Jason came out after the show and was like hiding under the merch table. And it's funny because I get to like have these conversations with him now and be like, oh yeah, that was kind of a rough time, you know, like, or whatever, you know, like you kind of get the insight of going back and sharing my fandom interactions and him telling me what place in life he was in at the time.
Yeah. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking also about another video I've seen on YouTube out there of Jason when he is touring with someone in Europe at like these house shows, and he's playing a cover of Kingfish Pies at this like, oh, wow, house show, and all I could think of was like, how cool does that have to be? Like, you know, you're such a fan of this guy, and then he's playing your cover song, you know, your music at a show in the future. That just has to be crazy to think about, but.
I love it. I mean, he'd actually do great at that song. He should come out and sing it with us every time we play.
Particle separation room is made without windows. Say it's because we don't let break in and take whatever they chose.
Did, you know, when Granddaddy reformed, I guess it was it 2012, we both played End of the Road, Midlake and Granddaddy, and I ended up actually riding on their bus back to London, and I did just a stripped down show, and Jason stuck around, and we did I think he sang Acts of Man, a Midlake song off of Courage of Others, and that was a lot of fun too. One, because just riding back on the bus with Granddaddy and hanging out with all the guys, and and then doing like a stripped down thing, and him joining us for a song. I think we did Heart of Gold as well.
So what's in the future for Midlake? I know that you guys recorded something new that's coming out soon, but maybe doesn't have a release date. Is that right?
Yeah, we recorded earlier this year, and really kind of wrote and demoed throughout the whole lockdown. So it was kind of the silver lining of being forced to kind of not go anywhere. And so we made a new record, and it will come out in February of next year. And we've got some dates coming up this year, but mostly next year. You know, hopefully things will clear up, but yeah, we're technically not announcing it for another month, but yeah, it's fine.
Okay, let's talk about your favorite Jason Lytle song.
Yeah, so my selected song, whether I would call it my favorite or not, was Broken Sure. Household Appliance, National Forest.
Sit on the toaster like a rock. No need to worry about a shock. All of the microwaves are dead, just like the salamanders.
You know, like I was saying, like the beginning of the song actually does feel more akin to the record, and then kind of that roots of Under the Western Freeway kind of come in, and that whole section, which I don't know if there's a story behind that or anything, or if, you know, sometimes an artist can acknowledge like, yeah, this is kind of a nod to, or a tip of the cap of where we've been. And that big, you know, E chord comes in, broken household appliance, you know.
Refrigerator's house, the frogs, the conduit is the hollow log. Broken household appliance.
It's just, I love it. I love that. How that feels. And it was really fun to play that song with him. And it was, when we did those Grand Lake songs, it was like, we got to basically write the set list, you know, and kind of like send it back and be like, could we do this set, you know, Jason? And I think he had a couple tweaks. It was like, yeah, it might be cool to do this song. I think he might add Go Progress Chrome or something. And we didn't have it originally. And some of it also was just like, I don't know his relationship with this song, if he would want to play it.
Yeah.
I think I've asked him to do Lava Kiss before, and he's like, no. Like, I love that song.
Yeah, a lot of people do.
that was one that I was really special to me to be able to do, because it's where it all began.
Yeah, we spoke with Jim Fairchild on the last episode, and he mentioned he was talking about just the timeline and how the software slump came together. And he said that Broken Household Appliance, National Forest, wasn't actually written at the same time a lot of those other songs had been written. So maybe that that's why it kind of feels a little bit jarringly different. So
yeah, and it almost sounds like, you know, it could be two songs that are kind of spliced or something, you know, just because of how the left turn that they take on that song.
Yeah, the transitions, it's just like it fades and then it comes back up with the drum fill and then it, or the drums, and then it fades back to the soft, to the soft intro again.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different type of transition than what Jason does, I'm thinking, a lot of the other songs.
Mm-hmm. Broken Household Appliance, National Forest is a great example where you have this beautiful progression, this kind of, you know, and we've done it too, where you kind of have this chromatic thing where kind of doing the augmented chord, and it's just this beautiful kind of trotting along. You just see this scenic nature scene building, and then, you know, it just, the bottom falls out. And it's, yeah, I think it's just a very unique thing, because that's not like just in the classical way of like, this is how a song is going to play out. It kind of goes against that, but yet he does it in a way that maintains the beauty. I know I've already kind of shared a bit about that, but it was my introduction. So, yeah. You know, that's a pretty big thing. I remember my friend Adam gave me the CD, and, you know, I'd always kind of go back to that track.
For me, it's such a strange song in the sense that its place in the lineup of the Software Slump, it just stands out as this, you know, drastically different song. Everything else in that album is, you know, fairly quiet. There's a couple of other rock songs, but that one is just, it almost has like these punk elements at times with the sloppy drum fill and everything else that goes in there. Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
That takes us to the end of the episode. A very special thank you to Eric Polito for sharing some great stories with us this week. There are only a couple of episodes left this season, which means that, yes, I have decided to do one more season next year. There's just too many people I'm still hoping to speak with. So until next episode, take care, everyone.